1. You're listening to the Beat Motel Zine podcast, and we need to warn you that we use words like shit, bollocks, scrotics, fuck, anarcho-syndicalist, and cunt, and we don't normally beat those words out, apart from the word cunt, because we're not total animals. Now, we know as well as you that your children can hear these words on any street in Britain, possibly any street anywhere in the world. But we also appreciate that you may not want to invite these words into your home if you have children or sensitive pets nearby whilst listening to this podcast. So listener discretion is advised. That being said, if your children aren't allergic to hearing words like fuck, shit, buttocks or hind penis, they might learn something from listening to this podcast, although probably not, because the quality of our educational content is quite poor. So there you go, fuckers, buckle in and let's get started.
Hello, everyone who listens
I
to me.
I never bade you go to Moscow or to Rome, renounce that drudgery, call the muses home.
Ah, Sam's being a book learning person.
I've been quoting Yeats, don't I?
I told you about this. Admittedly, listeners, this is going to be a slightly visual thing. Have I told you about my Fade and Miscellany? It's a really, really nice thing. So the whole point is it's a massive book. And when you want inspiration, you open it up and it's just got like random stuff. So you pick a choose at random. Pick a page at random.
Pick a choose.
And there will just be, you know, just something interesting.
It'd be great if there were Pikachus at random.
or just an image. But I was in a meeting with a prospective client. Well, their team, actually. There's two or three of them. And I was talking to them about this because I think it's really interesting. And I said, so you just open it up on a random page and, there'll be something there to inspire you. So they said, go on then. I opened it up and held it up to the screen and it was a pencil drawing of a vagina. I was like, oh, I've never seen that picture in there before. There's like, over 1,000 pages, and I was just like, I am so sorry. I am so sorry I showed you my vagina. Just, awful, but good. Amazing scenes. How are you, Sam?
I am fine. That is a very good practical joke to play on yourself.
It's hot you, here today. I'm a bit hot. It's hot. 11 degrees and I've walked to work.
11 degrees? Jesus
so, Christ. And it's sort of rainy. Is it still like Hoth's arsehole over there?
No, Finland? it's about 3 degrees and melty and sludgy and...
wet.
Yeah, I went on a bike ride and there's still a lot of winter to go.
Still, you describe it like something like toilet roll. Like, no, there's still plenty to go.
Yeah, you get to a point like there's some urban bike lanes that are very well and now melted, and you can go for a lovely, lovely time on that. And then you get towards more suburban areas, and then it all goes to shit.
It all goes mucky.
It all goes sludgy and mucky. Yeah.
Shall we have a riff of the week?
Oh, why not?
Let's have yours. The video for this, when I clipped it for video, it's so joyous. It is four or five lads just having a lovely old time. Just literally just like flinging their guitars around. Looks like they're in some sort of coastal defences somewhere. But who was that, Sam?
That was Darkest Hour. I don't know. There was a video to this. And they are like a metal band. I think I've talked about them before.
A metal band, like super, like doubly metal.
Yeah, doubly metal. I think I've talked about them before at different points, and this is sort of a comeback album, and I don't, you know, a lot of the album is a bit more miss for me. I think they sort of, the vocalist sort of ventures towards sort of more like, he doesn't ever really go clean singing, but it ventures towards clean singing, and in, I don't know, in like extreme metal, it just doesn't tend to work for me that much. But
so he doesn't go towards like the full-on Eurovision metal?
No, he doesn't go Euro metal, but he goes a bit like emo metal. And but on this track, it's just all out, balls to the wall, and it's just like, it's fucking great. Such a amazing way to start a song. Just, I mean, I think if they were braver, they would have put that as the first song. Just that's how you start an album. That's incredible.
So the song's called Societal Bile. Yeah. I mean, with metal, you know what you're getting with titles like that. But I'm looking forward to hearing the rest of the album. Have you ever tried to play bass guitar while you've got your balls to the wall?
I might have. I don't know.
It's a rite of passage that all bassists go through. Right. Anyone who hasn't listened to this so far, listened to this podcast before, this so far is fairly indicative of the way it goes. And I'll make my almost kind of cliched claim now that we're not a metal podcast. And then I'll go and play my riff of the week. Much to love in there. That's Dissimulator and the song's Neural Hack. Thanks to Rocky for sending that over to me. What do you think of that up your ears?
That was like tech deathcore. That sounded great.
Tech deathcore.
Yeah, that sounded like a technical version of a lot of stuff I've been listening to the last year. Send me the band name. I don't know how you'd spell that.
Dissimul. Oh yeah, I'll send it to you via WhatsApp.
Send it to me. Yeah. You know.
But that's
that sounds great. There's
stuff in there that I would have hated even a year ago that would have just maybe gone, no. Like the sudden shift in tempo and timbre. But now I just think it's fucking genius.
I would say but it could be the way I was listening to it and, you know, the medium where we have to listen to stuff through. The vocal sounded very high in the mix.
I'd go with that. That stops them being a texture and makes them a bit more of a feature, which I'm generally less of a fan of in any metal. I'm generally quite happy to go, oh, there's vocals.
I mean, it depends. Like, I was listening to what is now the classic Cannibal Corpse album, Kill, and I've never heard such good diction in extreme metal. And it really, the first track, the chorus is very catchy, and he sounds very demented, and you're quite scared. He seems like a very nice man, Corpse Grinder, and
sorry, I was still got a cold. His
Instagram is literally photos of his family, and he's really into like stuffed toys. And they go around sort of collecting them and then donate them.
It's like Danny Filth on Instagram. I just think it's kind of quite charming as well, because he's just sort of celebrating his life generally. He's not bragging about it. He's just kind of going, this is so cool. This is awesome. Wow, thank you, everyone. I love this.
The first track has Corpse Grinder is his stage name.
How do you grind a corpse? Is that like skateboard grinding, where you do an ollie and then go on the trucks, or is it like having a massive wheel of sandpaper?
I think you might do that. But the chorus is "Time to kill is now," and you sort of go, you want to back off from like where he is when he's doing that. It's quite intense.
Oh boy, so if he says like "time to kill is in about half an hour," you'll go, right, I've got time to lace my shoes up and find my coat. It's time to kill is now. Just run.
Time to kill is now. But you know, a guy called Corpse Grinder when he's bellowing "Time to kill is now" repeatedly. Well, he sounds genuinely demented. It's very good. It's a very good album.
I sort of get really fixated on things like diction. I heard the radio. They played "Rise" by Pill, which I still think that's almost a kind of "I'll fight anyone who says it's shit" kind of song. It's a good song. You know, it's got Steve Vai and Ginger Baker on it, for fuck's sake. But the diction of that period, Pill, John Lydon, he talks, it's so precise. And I don't know if he was deliberately trying to like counter accusations of being like an East End ruffian or something, but he speaks so, sings so precisely in that era, Pill, on all of it. I want to know the names of other people in Cannibal Corpse now.
Well, I think Corpse Grinder was his previous band. The same way that people take the Ramones names.
Mm.
I don't think anybody else has fun names.
I always thought the Ramones, if they had a carried on, I always thought it would have been good if they had like Ramon from Peru joining.
Ramones.
Ramon Maron.
Yeah, I mean, like the bassist who is brilliant bassist at Cannibal Corpse, the guy's... he's another sort of like one of those rare, you know, bassists in extreme metal who makes a really good point why the bass should be turned up more. I mean, his name is George Fisher. Oh, no, his name is
George Fisher.
No, Alex Webster. George Fisher is actually is Corpse Grinder. George Corpse Grinder.
George Corpse Grinder. Or G. So all his luggage is like. G C G, like a little monogram on his briefcase. He's a Cannibal Corpse.
I'd like to think Cannibal Corpse have monogrammed luggage for when they travel.
So, like names of people in metal bands and punk bands. There's a lot of crossover and a lot of really cool stuff. And then I always like the fact that when you look at a list of names of people in bands, sometimes there's someone who's just missed the point. Or just not quite got it right. So, I mean, we talked about Criminal before. You know, I'm friends with a couple of the guys in a Chilean band, metal band called Criminal. Mm. And I was always amused that looking at their band members, there was Anton, that's his name, Anton. You know, he's half German, half Chilean, worked for Metal Blade for years. There was Rodriguez, who actually legally sponsored into the UK so he could marry a friend of mine. My friend Staff, who works at Culture Strata Centre, Staff Glover. Again, Staff, that's just his name. And I always think it's awesome when you go when you play at Culture Strata Centre, all the T-shirts have Staff written on them so you know who works there and doesn't. It's just really confusing. Like, you're not Staff. He's also served time in ENT, as have many people. Then there's Olmo Casquella, there's Jose Joaquin Valiso, and then Jimmy Ponce.
Jimmy Ponce,
just no. Just why? How has somebody not just gone, mate, just don't. Just don't use that word. Just don't. Jesus Christ. Right. We have a theme for this episode, which I can't remember if it was your idea or my idea, Sam.
I can't remember. I have no idea. I just saw it on the list and I said, why not do that?
Well, do you want to explain it?
No.
Go on, you tell people while I open myself a can of pop.
No. I can't remember what it is. It's people covering their own music, which is sort of a unique phenomenon in a way in sort of pop music. But it's like jazz and, you know, classical music, you don't tend to play your own music. You tend to play a composer's music. In jazz, you have this idea. A lot of jazz has ideas of like, traditional, there's a jazz songbook of like things,
the standards,
but pop is quite unique in its way of sort of, you tend to have people do a recorded version, that's the definitive version, and everything else, and they don't really tend to re-record stuff again.
That's so fucking interesting. I did not get that angle at all when we talked about this, but that is, you're completely right. I love the idea that people can just keep on improving on it. Because if you're in a band, the classic thing is that you record an album when your band's been going for maybe a year. Then you carry on playing those songs. And 3 or 4 years later, basically you've made the songs much, much better. So I do like the idea. And
well, it's I think there's a capitalist discourse in a way to this sort of a relentless quest for new stuff rather than sort of being able to go back and reinterpret what you were doing in various ways. And also, like, yeah, improving stuff in an amount of time. I remember seeing Mike Watt and one of his sort of trios, and they were, I saw them at the beginning of the tour, and I saw them 2 years later at the end when they were finishing and they stopped playing the material. And they were such a different band and such a tighter wow. band and such a better band. And they recorded the album, and I always sort of was sad that they never did a live version of the album, because towards that end, that live stuff was so much in a better place than the recorded stuff, because they were more familiar with it, because they were better, because they knew their way around the material more, and therefore I think they felt more freedom to go through it in different ways. But
also, like, sorry, go on.
Thinking about it, it is sort of a capitalist, relentless desire for the new, that people don't generally go back and reinterpret their stuff. You've done that, move on to the next thing, rather than say, you know, what a lot of jazz musicians did, and a lot of, Charles Mingus, there is no sort of so-called definitive version of a lot of his music. There are several great interpretations, and, you know, the only person who might be the same from the original, you know, the original recording to the next recording might be Charles Mingus. That might be the only person there who actually was part of that writing session or original recording session. So you have different solos, you have different interpretations, you have different ways of feeling that beat as well.
I'm uncharacteristically silenced by that because it suddenly made me realize one of the things I've been missing out on by not listening to a lot of jazz, and that's the infinite variety. Because if you think how you listen to music in the modern way, so if you've got, I was going to say all your MP3s, I think we might slightly be past that, but a song can come on, you go, right, I love this track or this jazz number, and then it'd be quite exciting to see which one it is, because you'll always hear something new, that constantly evolving thing. I'm genuinely fascinated. I'm completely like, wow, that's really awesome.
I've never heard it, but apparently Radio 3 have a radio. BBC Radio 3 has a radio program where a bunch of classic music nerds get together and discuss the benefits of different recordings of the same piece of music.
Oh, that's even geekier than us.
Yeah, that's sort of going. Remarkable. Oh, the timbre on the. Trumpet this time just sort of wiggles something inside my anal glands.
Right, speaking of trumpet, let's have your first choice. Those drums are just bonkers. Go on, who was that, Sam?
That was Dizzy Gillespie with A Night in Tunisia from the Afro album. And this is one of the albums he pioneered. Dizzy Gillespie sort of pioneered two styles of jazz. He pioneered bebop, which everybody knows is sort of like the sort of fast soloing stuff. And then he also...
Sorry.
He was also a pioneer. He didn't pioneer by himself, but he was a pioneer in Latin themed jazz.
And that was what I found so surprising about how Latin influenced that is.
Well, it's called, I think may have called it Cuban jazz at the time, but and the people playing the hand drums, they're Cuban. And one of the reasons I picked that track is because, as I said before, a lot of jazz artists do reinterpret their stuff again and again and again. But this is him reinterpreting what had, by this point, I think his track is like 10 years old at this point. This composition is 10 years old at this point. he interprets it from a bebop standard, and it is a standard in jazz these days, to being, you know, and it was a standard at that point, to being a Latin sort of jazz number. And I think it's a really interesting sort of like how, you know, like how far and how different can you make it, rather than what a lot of jazz musicians might do, which is use the chords as a template to then do their own thing on. He really sort of goes quite far into reinterpreting it as a new, in a new genre.
So, what era are we talking here?
This is 1950s, mid 50s.
50s.
Yeah.
Because there was a thing at the time where if you had a hit record, you wouldn't release an album with lots of other songs wrapped around that, or like filler, or just, hey, here's the best 10 songs I've got at the moment. It was relatively normal that people would get a hit record, then release an album that was 10 different versions of that.
Yeah, that's true.
I'm thinking like Screaming. I think I learned this.
Screaming Jay Hawkins.
Yes, that's the one.
Yeah,
including
the
horrendously racist adaptations. Oh man, my nose is running so bad. I do apologize.
Yeah, I mean, but jazz. I was reading about jazz history. By this point in the 1950s, jazz, through the sort of modes of bebop, was mostly considered was mostly considered art music. So it didn't exist in the same realms of commercial sort of exploitation, shall we say, that pop music did. You didn't get jazz singles by and large at this point.
There's one more thing I want to discuss before we move on, and that's Dizzy Gillespie's funky trumpet.
Yeah.
Because the trumpet looks like, well, not just his cheeks when he's playing it, but his actual trumpet. There's several pictures I found of him. He looks like, you know, when you're a kid and you're running around with a stick and your parents tell you not to run around with a stick. Well, partly because it will jab you in the groin, which I'm afraid did happen to me a couple of weeks ago.
Andrew only has one child.
Now, his trumpet looks like he's run through, looks like he had a giant trumpet and he ran through a narrow door with it. And it got mangled, because instead of the trumpet pointing forwards, most of the trumpet points forwards, and then the end of the horn just goes wow, and just like points right up at the ceiling. And I can't think of any logical reason why that would be a good idea.
Please, listeners, please write in to tell us why Dizzy Gillespie has a askew horn.
It has a funky trumpet.
Funky horn.
It's at such an angle, it can't even be to like make sure the music or the sounds go over the heads of the audience and reach the back, because people sat down in chairs and they're up on stages, so like the trumpet would be pointed down at them anyway. Very strange. Right, I'm going to move on to my first choice, which, as usual, I've taken a slightly different angle on this, and it might be a bit of a challenge to, let's see if you know who this is, Sam.
What the fuck's going on there?
I just want to hear the first bit of the vocals. It came as such a surprise when I heard that. I was looking for this, and this came as such a surprise.
What the actual fuck? What the fuck's going on there?
Do you know who it is?
Well, it's Lay Lady Lay. I can't remember.
Wow. You got. I am genuinely impressed you got that from that. I really am.
But I can't remember who did it. And why would they?
Bob Dylan.
I thought it might have been Bob Dylan. Is that how he sounds like live? Is that what he sounds like live?
This is how he sounded live.
It's like a Vic Reeves interpretation.
I've got to hear
it. It's like it. Well, the band sound all right.
Oh, gee. The thing is, even the band, you can hear that it's Lay Lady Lay just about at the end. I am seriously so impressed that you got that. It's live in Stuttgart, 1991. And Bob Dylan is... There's bands like Wire who say, don't play old stuff because we're not going to be our own cover band. And I always think that's a missed opportunity in a lot of ways. There's people like Bob Dylan who've been singing the same songs for so long that quite famously, if you go and see Bob Dylan, you probably won't recognise half the songs just because they're so all over the place. And I picked that one because it's controversially, a lot of people think it's the best live recording of the Bob Dylan ever. And sensible people think it's fucking terrible.
It's just... What the fuck? I really wouldn't be surprised if he just got Vic Reeves really drunk and just shoved him on stage with Vic Reeves. He sounds like he's falling asleep. And it sounds like he sounds like he's on a lot of painkillers and he's falling asleep.
I'm pretty sure he's been straight edge since like the mid 60s, but that performance is just wild, isn't it? It sounds like he's mumbling to himself. And it's not like if you hear Bob Dylan now, like, did you ever hear his Christmas album that he did 2 or 3 years ago? Because it is the creepiest thing.
I don't seek out Bob Dylan.
I don't seek out Bob Dylan. No. may not change after hearing that.
No, it doesn't.
So there's my example of someone who's just been playing the same songs for so long that he's twisted and mangled them so much they're completely unrecognisable. I think I've actually got left you speechless with that.
I mean, one takes the piss out of Bob Dylan for not really being able to sing, but you know, in the grand scheme of things. We listen to a lot of music where the singer doesn't really have a lot of tonal range. But, I mean, at least they fucking try.
It sounds like in one bit, it sounds like it's going, I haven't got a brass section. Literally just like, it's so out of time and so off kilter. But let's move on to something far cooler. Here we go.
Punk rock band,
we're a new wave band. This is when you told me you wanted this clip, and I was like, damn it, I wanted that. Tell us the history of it. It's one of my favorite music moments.
So it's Pull My Strings by the Dead Kennedys, and they were invited to play a music ceremony. I don't know what music ceremony, frankly. My history of this song is not very good. I just love the song. And they start by playing California Uber Alice, which is obviously their big song and has got them sort of kudos and hits and stuff like that. But then they've just decided to go, no, fuck it. And they write a completely different song for the... I think they even sound checked. I think in my head, this is a story that happened. They even sound checked California Uber Alice, and then they just pulled the rug out and they wrote a song about how shitty the music industry is, and they performed it to the music industry.
It's so glorious. They went on stage wearing shirts just with an S on them.
Yeah.
So just like a big S, and then when they flip to, you say that, yeah, they wrote the words, but it's My Sharona by the Knack is what they're actually playing. That's and they not... they had it is it's my oh they play a bit of My Sharona in it. They absolutely do, definitely they, do.
Yeah, but the whole that
My opening, Paola.
That opening riff is not My Sharona.
No, you're right. I've never really given that much thought, but yeah, you're totally right. But they have black ties on, like backwards, so they turn the ties around to make dollar signs. But yeah, as you say, just turning up The only thing I can think of, other thing I can think of like that happening at an award ceremony is KLF turning up to do a version of, God, I could have chosen that. KLF turning up to do a version of 3AM with some extreme noise terror at the Brit Awards, which is, again, it's just a completely joyous clip to watch if you look it up. Because Bill Drummond's in stitches and Extreme Noise Terror, who, you know, the Ipswich band, Dean, they had given it the proper grindcore version. And Bill Drummond's just looking around, just going, wow. Well, actually, he's firing a machine gun blanks into the crowd. But, glorious. But yeah, Dead Kennedys doing their own cover and then subverting it is just.
What happened to musicians, popular musicians, playing pranks on the industry? That was good.
That is an exceptionally good question. Right, if you are a platinum selling musician, then please email in and tell us why you're being so lame.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right, the next track, there's several reasons I chose it, and I do realize it's not strictly a cover, but here we go.
Maybe I should scratch.
My real name is My sister's name was
Do you know what that is?
No, what's that?
Wow, I thought you'd know that. It's Beastie Boys.
Oh, it's a bit early hip hop for me.
It is very, very early hip hop.
Is that the first thing they did? No.
It's kind of them getting to that point. It's on an album which they put out in the 90s called Some Old Bullshit, which was literally just a collection of loads of 7 inches and stuff.
Oh, I've never listened to that.
Well, the album's kind of, it's mostly not particularly great hardcore, but there's a few tracks on it, and one of them is Beastie, B-A-S-T-E, and it's just, you know, God, I misspelt it. So it's just like a hardcore song, like B-A-S-T-E, B-A-S, and like that. But that track that I just played is Cookie Puss, which is them, yeah, starting to sort of fuck around with hip-hop. And it's not really hip-hop yet. And there's other bits on the album that are a bit more dub. So it's like that is absolutely dub. But the little scratchy bits I'm pretty sure them scratching some of their earlier stuff, but the B-E-A-S-T is definitely them using older stuff. It's just weird. I don't know if it's sampling or whatever, but it is very much a band mucking around with their own back catalogue.
Yeah, that's cool. That's an interesting thing to do. That brings the remix concept a whole new light, really.
Yeah, I do like that idea. Whereas there was a couple of Zeeb songs that I could have used in this, because we used to put two versions of the same song on albums, but I decided that would be a bit too indulgent. No, that's not the truth. I don't care about being indulgent. I was just in the shower and I thought of him. By the time I'd started walking to work, I'd forgotten all about it. So let's go for your next choice.
Ooh, 1, 2, 3, 4, who's punk? What's the score?
I don't know. Like, I know who that is, but I'll leave you to reveal that.
That's Jawbreaker, the song Boxcar, which was re-recorded for their major label debut, Dear You, which was beforehand on the album that they had recorded beforehand. And
oh, shit, beforehand. That happens a lot. I've got an example of that.
They were sort of, because they had written this sort of, they were signed up in the Green Day signing spree, post-Green Day signing spree, and post-Nirvana signing spree of the mid-90s, when the major labels were desperate to get on
Like, do you know what a guitar is? Yes. Here's a £1 million record contract.
Pretty much. And they resisted it for quite a long time, and then they sort of went for it. And they recorded this really nice album, which is quite sorrowful. It's like art pop punk. And there's lots of really interesting chord changes, just like early emo pop punk. But it's lots of lovely chord changes and really interesting chords. And there's not a lot of hooky choruses. It's a really, really good album. And then I think they were sort of pushed to re-record Boxcar because that was sort of their pop song. And the record label, as far as I understood it, the record label sort of went, well, you know, this is a good album, but there's no hit. Where's your hit? We need a hit. That's in the contract, boys. they recorded this album and broke up.
Oh, God. It did happen a lot, the kind of, hey, you major label, then we're done. But I know the name Jawbreaker, and I don't think you've chosen them before, so I have heard them before, but were worth a deep listen?
There's something on the first few. Frankly, this is going to be upset anybody who listens to us who likes Jawbreaker. I can't really stand the production of the first few albums. But then the Dear You album has really great production. And it's a really nice album to put on in the background. And then little bits and pieces of it just get lodged in your head. There's a great, probably the best song, my favourite song from it is Sluttering. And that has an incredible chorus, to be fair. That one should have been the hit single. I'm just going to go and get my coffee. I'll be right back.
Okay, Sam is gone to get his coffee. Has he, what? Are you got to make some more? I don't know why I'm speaking to him. He's taking his headphones off. I'm trying to debate with myself whether to tell him about the email or the message we've had about the Metallica episode. Shall I or shall I not? But he's gone for now, so I'm just filling for a few minutes. The noise you can hear in the background, by the way, is the 3D printer I have in the studio, because what studio wouldn't have a 3D printer? I'm currently printing something called Adam. I don't know what it is. It's something from a TikTok meme that my daughter requested I print. And I've got no idea what it is. Sam's back. This is where I find out if he's been able to hear what I've been saying.
Hello?
You make coffee very quickly. Was that...
Oh, it was ready-made. I just hadn't bought it.
Oh, wow. We've been recording for 37 minutes. You just hadn't quite got round to it.
No, it was probably... It's a bit lukewarm.
I'm reading a really interesting sci-fi book at the moment. Incidentally, I've just read Project Hail Mary, which is so good. It's written by the same guy who wrote The Martian. Absolutely brilliant. So I'm now reading his third book. It's called Artemis, and it's based on the moon. Loads of people live on the moon, but on the moon they can't drink tea because of the lower gravity. Water boils at 60 degrees centigrade, so no one can drink proper tea, which I think is a really nice detail to kind of have in a sci-fi
book.
Such
an English book.
I love it.
We can't go to the fucking moon. You can't, because why not? Because you can't have a proper cup of tea. Oh, I can't wait to get back to Earth. Boom. Why? Because you're missing your family now. I just want a proper brew.
Just some tea.
So
leaving Jawbreaker, I think we ought to do a few kind of 90s 90s guitar band things, because there's despite the fact I was there, well, you were there as well, but I was a bit older. I just don't know it. Right, so here is, oh God, we're rattling through the choices this week. This is a song I'll play it, then I'll explain it. I've chosen a really odd part of it as well. So that was The Charlatans with a track called Subtitle. And I chose that because, do you remember when bands used to put out 12 inches in between albums? Which I just don't think's a thing anymore and hasn't been for about 25 years.
No, you're old.
So the Charlatans had a surprise, I think it'd be fair to say, a surprise hit first album. It was absolutely huge, even though it's not actually very good. But then they released an EP quite soon after called Overrising, which again, is not very good. But there was a really simple, really, really basic song on it called Subtitle that was just like a bass riff, and just really stripped back. And then this album came out a couple of years later called Between the 10th and 11th, and they re-recorded the song with the most ridiculously over-the-top production. It was produced by Flood. And
of The Killing Jokes.
The Killing Jokes. I chose that clip because that little bass throbby bit, I used to, when my very first band was, that was our going on stage music, I clipped just that little bit. Clipping back then being a C90 tape and then pressing the pause button to take it off, you know, to record and then back again. But I think that's an example of a band covering one of their own songs and arguably making it far less interesting.
But this is the thing is that, you know, there's numerous examples, and I mean, I didn't pick any, but there are examples of bands covering their own stuff and making it worse. You know, they sort of, and this sort of, you know, to go back to that conversation of like, why don't, you know, there is an argument to be made that music is about the instantaneousness of it. So instead of having different versions of a song, we get a live album. So you can't really recreate that magic because, you know, there's that song. I mean, that Boxcar version is good, but it also feels a bit sad because it is that major label insistence that it was done. But, you know, it's if you're, can you really sort of, you know, is that thing of like, can you really, like pop punk is a particular music, or punk is a particular music which is supposed to be about intensity and instantaneousness in a way. So can you then go back and re-examine it and reorchestrate it in a way by the same people when they know it, you know, much better and they're not as excited by it, but they think, well, maybe we can make money out of this?
I think the shallow money trench part of that is probably quite pertinent. So obviously Charlatans aren't punk, but Green Day had an obscure B-side, and I can't even remember what album it was off, but it was, what I'm going to say, the early albums. I still count Dookie as an early album. It's what, third?
Third album, yeah.
There was a B-side, I think, earlier on that was then redone many years later and became a hit, and that's Good Riddance, Time of Your Life. That really? Was a fairly sort of mid-paced, full guitar, I seem to remember it was full guitar, full band song, and then it just sort of reappeared again years later as this stripped-down acoustic thing and became a hit single. And I can remember Billy Joe Armstrong playing that on Top of the Pops, and Top of the Pops clearly didn't know what to do with him, so they put him on a stool, like a classic singer-songwriter stool with an acoustic guitar with all these confused-looking teenagers sat around him while he played this, frankly, quite sad song. But there's...
early version of the song, simply titled Good Riddance, appeared as a B-side to the European single for Brain Stew, Jaded, which is the album before Nimrod.
Okay, so no, it wasn't years, it probably was years. That's probably 2 or 3 years before, isn't it? Do you know what? Sometimes I give you facts on this podcast, and then I think, did I imagine that? So I feel quite relieved sometimes when you're there looking up the information.
I'm very glad when... I'm very glad that you put as much sort of effort into fact-checking what you're talking about there as I do.
People don't listen to this for facts. They listen to it because they love our sexy voices.
I think they listen to it because if anybody listens to it at all, it just reminds them of two idiots talking in a pub.
Well, what more could anybody want?
It's what you want. This is what a podcast should be these days, rather than these fucking assholes who are trying to be so ambitious with all that shit. Fuck you. No, this is just about self-help and self-care.
We would do this if nobody listened. And I know that's like a very trendy thing to say. Like, oh, no, we'd do it. We don't do it for the... No, we really would. We would. It's a lovely way of staying in contact with you when, because you live miles away.
In a way, this has just replaced what was our WhatsApp conversations.
Yes. But it's nice to actually kind of go into depth. And yeah, as many years as I've known you and loved you, Samuel, you constantly surprised me, and you constantly surprised me with your choices on this. So this choice surprised me.
Hey, Mickey, you're so fine, you're so funny. That's what people say. That's what people say. I go on too many dates, but I can't make them stay. At least that's what people say. That's what people say.
Oh, man, I've got hairy nips.
Who's that?
What?
Who's that?
You chose this. Go on, who is it?
Swifty Pie with the hit song Shake It Off, because she shook off. She has made an industry, essentially, of shaking off her previous exploitative industry relationship, industry relationship, and recorded... note for note, slightly, the sound is slightly different. Her own versions of some of at least maybe all her hit albums. I'm not sure she's gone so far back to sort of doing stuff around her country music stuff, but I don't listen to Taylor Swift. It's not my thing. It's not my generation. It's not my world.
You can't deny, though, that is a tune.
Yeah, based on
Hanger of a song.
You're based on "Hey Mickey, you're so fine, you blow my mind."
Oh shit, you're right. Okay, you've ruined it. Or made it better, maybe.
I mean, I have a lot of time for "Hey Mickey" because it's such a ridiculous piece of music. But she, you know, fair play to her. She did exactly, you know, what she needed to do, and she used, and she's using, one might say, exploiting her fan base rather than moving on, but. You know, she's, I don't know the details about it, but she is now in a contract that I imagine is much more reasonable to her remuneration behind it. And she owns the copyrights and the rights to all the master recordings, which I think was the big thing. And fair play to her. She exploits her market incredibly well.
This kind of re-recording thing, I find it absolutely fascinating that it's happening at Taylor Swift level, you know, so at such a high level. But it's something that's been around for a very long time. So when CDs first became a thing, my dad eventually bought a CD player, and he would buy CDs. Seemed insanely expensive. Despite the fact he probably spent £400 on a CD player, he wouldn't spend like 10 quid on CDs. But he used to buy these 60s hits compilations. And he bought two or three. Then he sort of stopped all of a sudden. And when I asked why, he said they always sounded wrong. And what was happening was, bear in mind that the time span was probably mid-60s. In my dad's opinion, all music stopped in 1966. He likes stuff after that, but he says, like, that's when the good stuff stopped. So there were hits on there from 1966, and he would have bought a CD player maybe 1987, conservatively, so 20 years distant. And what was happening was, because only people my dad's age who were middle class could afford CDs, and there became this massive nostalgia thing. So all these compilation albums were coming out, but the record industry was so fucked in the 60s that no one knew who owned the rights to anything. So you'd have all these bands, bands that would have been big, and they'd be approached, can we have one of your songs? And they'd be like, to be honest, we don't know who owns the rights. So they'd go, all right, pop in the studio and record it again. They'd go, all right. So you buy these compilation albums, all the original musicians, the songwriters and everything, but new versions, because it releases you from that mechanical right. And there are other bands. There are bands I know, the Addicts, for example. They re-recorded all their albums. Not that long, probably about 10 years ago, actually. But it's a relatively, it's like a loophole. It's quite a neat thing to be able to do, just to break yourself out of a restrictive contract. But I've never had the need to.
But you also have, but there's also, the finances that go into doing that is another thing as well. You know, the Addicts are established band. If they weren't an established band, doing that would just be pointless.
Hmm.
Even if they were just, it'd be like, until the Slits were rediscovered, it'd be like the Slits re-recording their album just for no one to listen to it again. And with Taylor Swift, she knew that she had a fan base that was going to, embrace and really go for these new versions because they are loyal to her. And it's fair play to her, but there's also an aspect of, I'm pretty sure she could afford to buy the master recordings as well. Maybe the record company was not prepared to release them either, because you can't buy something that's not for sale.
But she,
no means was she, no.
Was she the 100% songwriter though? Because that's the other aspect to it.
Well, I don't know. I don't know.
Because you've got Beyonce working with like 35 songwriters to make one song and stuff like that.
Oh yeah,
I genuinely don't. But the songwriters for Taylor Swift might have all been independent, or she might have written 100%, 100% of the songs.
Beyonce has gone country music, hasn't she? That's the other thing.
I've heard it, and I think I'm super skeptical about it.
What have you heard? Very important moment in Western culture, it will lead to the fall of the Russian Empire.
Okay, cool. Right, my last choice has no intelligence to it, but I do realise I chose this for the same reason you chose one of the earlier songs. Sorry, still needs me to cut off the vocals like that. Dear. So, Sam, who was that?
That was Nirvana with "Rape Me."
That was
Groin Day.
That was the Green Days with "Welcome to Paradise," which is on Kaplunk, and then it's also on their major label debut, Dookie.
Dookie Dookie, and it was a major hit.
It was, and that it's really cool because it's a major hit with a really long middle eight. I mean, that's quite long for a pop punk single, that build up. But I chose that bit because I can remember that being one of the things that really made me prick my ears up with Green Day.
Mm.
That is it. Trey Cole was the bassist, wasn't he?
No,
sorry, my brain's Matt no. Trey Cole was the drummer. That's right.
Yeah.
But that bass playing was suddenly like, hey, I really, really like this.
Yeah, he's a great bass
player. The build up of it all and the drumming, and just like Green Day are a brilliant band. I'm going to go back and listen to more Green Day because my daughter's getting into guitar music and she's been playing Nevermind like on a loop, which is all right. but it's a bit like I kind of want to go, okay, well, you've sampled vanilla ice cream. Now here's a Knickerbocker Glory with cherries and sparklers, and you know what I mean?
I don't know. Like it, I don't know. Like Nirvana's Nevermind is like a grungy version of a Queen album. There's so many. It's so well put together. It's, you know, like you've had.
See, I love the fact you say that as a positive. So many people would take that as like a massive insult. I know where you're coming from, though.
You've had, you've lived with that album for, you know, 30 plus years now. And if it still hits people, you know, and the generation that your daughter is, that's so cool. You know, because that was crack, music crack when I was a kid, and if it still maintains that potency, that's really cool. What you have to look out for is the music that she starts to adopt, because it fucks you guys off.
First of all, yes, I completely agree. I was laying in bed reading a book, and she was listening to. She's got like one of those Amazon Music things, which sound really amazing for how small they are. And she's learned now that if she puts it on an empty box, it's much louder and the bass sounds better. So again, celebrating that. But yeah, listen to the whole of Nevermind from start to finish. And I thought, it still stands up. It's such a good album. It's so well done.
I think people dismiss Nevermind because it was commercially successful and they produced it well. Basically, snobs depriving themselves of joy.
God, that's I am fully on board with that mentality for God, so much music. And anyone who watches the video, this seeing Sam and I dancing to Taylor Swift a minute ago.
I was reading myself. Not all the way, ladies, or gentlemen and gentlemen.
You can see my top half.
I was reading a paper yesterday about Korn, the metal band, rather than either the foot thing or food.
The foot thing.
And in the paper, they sort of, the guy compares Korn fans to Meshuggah fans. And he talks about how in depth people, he found this internet, these people talking about stuff on the internet, and these Meshuggah fans talking about like the cleverness of Meshuggah. And it's like, I'm sorry, you don't, You may rationalize why you like Meshuggah through the cleverness of their music, but at a certain point, that music just hits.
Mm.
And frankly, first Korn album just hits. It's a fucking brilliant album. And they were doing something genuinely new. And if they pissed you off because they were popular and different, they were doing something right.
Despite the fact we've recorded nearly 70 episodes of this podcast pontificating about music, it does all come down to the state that there is music I love and I really enjoy listening to, and I cannot tell you why I like it.
That's the joy of sort of exploring these things, is because you can never come up with an answer. It's like it's basically a variation of philosophy. Music is, there's no such thing as good music or bad music. Music just is, and if it hits you, it hits you, and you can't, you know, you're right. If you can't rationalize it, that's not a bad thing.
I think that is a very nice sentiment to end this episode on. So thank you very, very much, Sam. Thanks, everyone, for listening. And our subscriber numbers are going up, but not enough people have contacted me. Although we did get... we did get a message, someone saying, Kill 'Em All is not shit. It's the only exciting thing they ever did. Take it from someone whose favourite band used to be Metallica. They were great until they'd used up all Dave Mustaine's riffs halfway through Master of Puppets. Everything they did after that, especially the Black Album, was boring as fuck.
Megadeth never produced a decent album until Rust in Peace. Everything else before that was shit.
I just love it. It just goes to prove the point so wonderfully, so absolutely brilliantly, that we all like different stuff.
Yeah, and but that person's wrong.
Fantastic. Right, brilliant. Okay, well, thanks for your gorgeous time today, Sam. I love you deeply, and
I couldn't pontificate on 10 great, you know, moments of Megadeth tracks because they're all kept in one song, and you just listen to the song.
Well, it's efficient, isn't it? Isn't that just efficient rather than releasing Megadeth, 10 or 15 albums?
Dave Mustaine is not an amazing riff writer. Anyway, I'm arguing with myself at this point, but this is the point.
I don't know. You're arguing with the wrong person.
Whoever wrote in, fuck you, never write in again, you are a useless so-and-so. Stop doing whatever you're doing and just sit and, you know, try and live off benefits because... You're obviously not good at what you do.
I know who wrote in, and he knows I love him.
Anyway, I'm joking. I love them. Goodbye. Who's that?